It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning. We're missing Maria this
week. We are missing Maria.
We're doing tag team. I was sick last week, and she's sick this week. So.
Yeah, so you gave her whatever you had. And then...
Exactly, and then got better. So hopefully she'll be back next week.
It's weird how that works. I wonder who she's going to give it to.
It's hard to believe we spent 6 years doing this with just me. It's been a good couple of years having her on the program.
Yeah, definitely. So
we'll have her back next week,
or keep your fingers crossed.
Yes.
All right. Well, this week plenty to cover. Looks like there's a new episode of the reality show Nanny Gate out this week.
Who's your nanny? Bernard Carrick, who is the Bush appointee for the Department of Homeland Security, has gone down in flames after discovering, as part of the preparation of forms filling out for Senate confirmation, that he had hired a nanny and housekeeper who was an illegal immigrant, and he had not paid her Social Security taxes as they are wont to do. And this is something that that actually trips up far more cabinet nominees than almost anything else. In fact, I counted at least four or five during Bush and Clinton time. There was let's see, there was Linda Chavez in 2001, Labor Secretary nominee. We had Zoe Baird in Clinton time. We had Lonnie Chenier, who was Clinton's choice to head the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. We had Kimball Wood as his Attorney General. All of these various muckety-muck insiders in Washington who have to hire their domestic help. It really tells you what type of class these nominees come from. But what was really more amazing about the sinking of Carrick this time is that it was this that brought him down, and not any of the other things that critics had pointed to. He was already being adjudged to be the most vulnerable of Clinton's nominees for the cabinet position, and there were a number of reasons for this. He had previously been New York City's police commissioner, and he was police commissioner during 9/11, and was a protege of Rudolph Giuliani, the very influential former Republican mayor of New York. But after he had left his post as New York City police commissioner, he had gotten rich with Taser International, and you can kind of guess what they make. He had exercised his stock options with them, and they had resulted in his getting $6.2 million off of that get-rich-quick scheme. And he had also been involved in going to Iraq and doing some kind of questionable trainings there for troops, I believe.
Yeah, it was kind of ironic that he got from Taser International. One of their big contracts was with the Department of Homeland Security, and then of course he's going to head that up, huh?
Yeah. It's very much emblematic of the kind of insider ball playing that goes on in the Bush administration. That all the corruption that happens, calling of people to regulate these agencies from the ranks of folks who do business with the agencies or who run companies that are supposed to be regulated or otherwise, you know, episodes of foxes governing the hen houses. It's really a remarkably corrupt administration in that way.
All right, so moving along, it looks like we're having another oil spill. We've had a couple small ones here in Washington State of late, and now they're having a much bigger one up in Alaska.
Yeah, and it was a ship that came from Tacoma, which is a reminder once again of the problems that pass through the Puget Sound every day. But this ran into rough waters off on Alaska Island in the Aleutians, a very, very remote part of Alaska with hellacious weather, and this is one reason why they've been having such trouble both in responding to the accident scene and in cleaning up the oil spill. It was a Malaysian liner carrying soybeans to China, a ship called, and I hope I get this right, the Selendang IU. And it's been spilling 480,000 gallons of heavy bunker oil that is used to fuel the ship. They don't know how much of it has been spilled. The holds have been breached, but they haven't been able to get to the ship to find out how many holds have been breached. But the efforts to contain the spill have been made much more difficult by the harsh weather there, and of course they had the loss of six of the crew members also when a helicopter crashed during the rescue attempt. But this is a place that's in the midst of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, so it's an area that's rich in salmon and sea otter and otter and sea lions and all sorts of all sorts of critters that are going to be adversely affected by this oil spill. Yeah, it's not as large as the Exxon Valdez spill in 87, but it's still pretty significant and a reminder once again of how difficult it is to prevent these kind of spills.
Yeah, one more benefit from our oil-dependent economy.
Yeah, very much so. And a reminder once again also that that it's a very much a global economy, that this stuff gets shipped all over, and these kind of disasters can happen anywhere, including right here.
All right. Well, moving on to our next item, the intelligence bill, House intelligence bill, has been being talked about for weeks now. Almost months, it seems like, and looks like they're finally making headway.
It looks like they're finally making headway, but as with many of these complex bills that senators and Congress people don't bother to read before they pass, all sorts of unsavory details are now coming out about what was actually in the bill. You would kind of hope that these details come out of these bills before they get voted on, so people can actually make an informed decision. But no, we don't do business that way in the United States. So anyway, they talked about that a little bit on Counterspin. Also, some of the things that are in the bill. But one particularly troubling aspect that came to light this week was the expanded use of watch lists, the terrorism watch lists that the government operates, where they secretly compile a list of thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of names that are on the list of people who are. This is a much broader list than the no-fly list. It's just a list of people the government wants to keep an eye on. They don't tell you who's on the list. They don't tell you how people get on the list, what the criteria are, what any kind of redress that an individual might have if they find their name accidentally on the list. All of these stuff is kept very secret until, you know, incidents happen. It's happened with Senator Edward Kennedy, who was actually detained and told he couldn't fly at one point because his name was similar to the name of somebody that was on a watch list. So these kind of accidents are happening all the time. So the watch list is going to be very much expanded under this new bill. It's going to include now all airport personnel, people who work even if it's in a restaurant or anything beyond a checkpoint of airport security. It's now going to be checked off against the terrorist watch list. Same thing for cruise ship passengers and people who work on cruise ships. They don't want anybody smuggling a bomb on board a cruise ship, heaven forbid. Not when you can just, T-bone a small ship into the large cruise ship and do it much more simply that way. It really is an enormous expansion of the watch list. Many, many more people are going to be checked off against it. And the question, again, as with all of this, is how is the government held accountable for what it does? How do we know what it's doing? There's very little transparency to any of this, and it's very troubling.
Yeah, well, and then you look at, with the first item we had, when you have people like Bernard Carrick as as potentially the top dog for being in charge of programs like that, it's just not inspiring any way you look at it.
No, it really isn't. You wonder how many of the people who are top dogs who are running these agencies, should be on the terrorist watch list as opposed to, somebody who's a former police commissioner, used to run the jails in New York City, probably has a lot of unsavory contacts himself. That's not the class of person that we wind up on watch lists. We usually appoint them to high places instead.
And as you pointed out, people should, obviously our elected officials should actually, once in a while read these things. And it was one of the two lone voices to vote against this intelligence bill was Senator Robert Byrd, for exactly the reasons you mentioned. He said, why don't we spend enough time to actually check out all the different aspects of this bill before we vote for it? So.
Yeah, and as we said, now it's going to be signed into law, and there really is no form of redress except for potentially Congress passing another law to fix the mistakes that it made the first time.
All right, well, jumping to international news, the Ukraine still appears to be working on their electoral issues.
Yeah, much more effectively than they do here in the United States, we might add, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But the opposition candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, who checked into a Vienna hospital this week again for his third attempt at tests to determine whether he had actually been poisoned, presumably by government agents as part of the run-up to this election, and it came back positive. He is a victim of dioxin poisoning. And if you've seen any photos of this guy, the before and after photos are really striking, whereas before he had what are described by a lot of people as like movie star type looks, and now his face is pockmarked and swollen, and his eyelids droop on one side, and it's very clear that something is wrong with him, and it came back as positive for dioxin at 1,000 the times normally found in the bloodstream and in tissues. So something happened to him, and there'll be a criminal investigation now. But in the meantime, the movement that Yushchenko has started made some huge progress this week, signing into law, got through parliament in conjunction with the current president, Leonid Kuchma. They got a compromise bill through that made some pretty sweeping constitutional changes in the Ukraine, reining in the power of the presidency, expanding the power of parliament there. And all of this was made possible by the crowds of people that camped out in the streets of Kiev and other cities in Ukraine after the election on November 21st, saying that it was a fraudulent election, saying that the government had been lying. And of course, we had the incident with the interpreter on state-run television signing that this is all lies and she wasn't going to do it anymore. And it inspired 200 journalists, the state-run radio and TV networks, to say, we're not going to do this anymore. I mean, you wonder what it would take for somebody at Fox News to do something like that. All of this resulted in the Supreme Court handing down a decision about a week ago that the original vote was invalid. They're going to do a revote on December 26th, which almost certainly will name Yushchenko as the new president. And it was the crowds of people who came into the streets after the election and said, no, this is fraudulent. This was the governing party, suppressing opposition votes. That was unacceptable, and you really wonder why they can get that in the Ukraine, and you can have all manner of problems with voter recounts in Ohio and Florida and touchscreen voting and all the questionable use of suppression of voter rolls in this country, the redistricting and gerrymandering and all of the things that are being done to undermine democracy in this country. What it would take to get people out into the streets like that, to say no more, we don't want our democracy taken away from us. And the difference, of course, is that in Ukraine, democracy is a very new thing. They can remember 80 years of communist rule. They can remember hundreds of years of Russia, which backs the governing party there. Very, very close ties to Moscow for the governing party. They can remember hundreds of years of being ruled by Russians. So there's a lot of nationalism in the country and a lot of determination to not allow autocrats and bureaucrats to take democracy away from them. Whereas here in this country, we're bombarded from birth with all this jingoistic bilge about how wonderful our democracy is and how it's better than any place else in the world, and we do it right here, and we have freedom and democracy, and we export it to the rest of the world because we're so much better at it than they are. You really wonder what it will take to get people to examine more closely what's being done here in our name and to us in this country.
Yeah, we export a lot. We apparently are down on our imports of late, so...
Yeah, very much so. And I think Maria talked about this last week also, talking about exporting democracy, how it was confirmed that that we had some involvement and foreknowledge in this country in the Venezuelan coup attempt a couple of years ago. Did she talk about that here last week?
Oh, we were going to. I don't think we actually ended up mentioning that.
Okay. Well, in any event, that's or my, there that is.
My memory's hazy either way. But, yeah, the Freedom of Information Act request that it brought out.
Yeah,
brought
exactly.
Out.
Exactly. So you can find out about it. You know, there's transparency in our government. It just takes a few years, you know, long after the original act is made.
Well, in this case, that was relatively quick to bring out the info on that. I mean,
yeah, so it's only been 2 or 3 years.
There's still stuff from the Cold War and World War II we're still waiting for. So, all right. Well, anything else on that?
No. All right. Plenty.
Then I guess that moves us to this week in Iraq.
This week in Iraq.
Iraq. Yeah, a lot happened in Iraq this week. Donald Rumsfeld took it on the chin, which is something I think a lot of people were waiting to see happen.
Yeah, and getting hard questions from soldiers.
Yeah, getting you wonder why journalists can't ask those questions. Although as it came out, I guess a journalist helped put the soldier up to the question that the trip down Rumsfeld. But it's no less a legitimate question for that, and you could tell that because when Thomas Wilson, who is an airline mechanic based out of Kuwait, asked the question of Rumsfeld, the entire hall erupted in applause. And it really floored Rumsfeld. He sort of castigated casted around for a while before rambling to the conclusion that, well, this is the army you got, and we got to make do with what we have. You know, it's remarkable how out of touch politicians in Washington are with the reality of what's happening on the ground in Iraq. It makes you wonder whether the Bush administration actually believes all of the nonsense that it spouts out about the rosy assessment of what's going on there and how difficult conditions are in the field. I mean, we've talked in this program, Maria has talked repeatedly about how inadequate the arming of soldiers in Iraq is, and the lack of body armor. And if the Americans don't have it, you can be sure that the new Iraqi police and army recruits don't have any armor at all. It really is appalling that people are being sent into the battle under these conditions. But Rumsfeld took it on the chin. He drew a lot of heat, a lot of immediate Democratic. You know, there were a lot of people seizing on this issue as though it's a new issue that people hadn't known about before. It really took a momentum of its own this week. So you had the Pentagon ordering a company called Body Armor Holdings, which is the company that makes the heavily armored Humvees for the military. It turns out they had a much greater production capacity than had been used previously. So the Pentagon has ordered them to ramp up production which won't happen until February, by which time, you know, who knows how many more soldiers will have died. But that order could have been made months ago. That could have happened ages ago, and it could have saved a lot of lives. It took that one soldier's question to put this all into motion. It's remarkable.
And there has been congressional people who have been pushing for that for a long time. You know, in addition to shows like ours that have been talking about it, like a Strickland, I can't remember which. I think he's from Ohio. Has been pushing for that for, God, well over a year.
Yeah, but this administration doesn't respond to congressional critics. It certainly doesn't respond to the public. But the soldier has tremendous credibility in holding the government's feet to the fire, much more so than anybody else, because these are the people who are being put in harm's way by administration policies.
Right, especially since the press was there to actually capture that moment. So
yeah. Yeah, it almost has to involve the high muckety muck for anybody to pay attention, because if it's a Department of the Army undersecretary for whatever it is, nobody's going to be there and nobody's going to notice. Even though it may be a high muckety muck within the Army hierarchy, there'll be no press there to cover it, and no name recognition amongst the public to seize upon a personality like Rumsfeld as being held accountable. So we had the difficulty with that, but at the same time, yesterday was the deadline in Iraq for registering for the January 30th elections, and the political force in Iraq, the main political force, the high Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who when he says things, people listen, and people jump to attention and they make things happen. He helped negotiate to put forward something called the United Iraqi Alliance, which will field 228 different Shiite candidates for the elections next month. Now, most Sunni groups have said they're going to boycott the elections. There was one Sunni group, the Iraqi Islamic Party, that they quietly submitted a 275 candidate roster. There'll be 275 candidates in the new parliament, which will drop the new constitution for the permanent Iraqi government, which is one reason why Maria has been calling it the interim government. This will become only the interim government once this holds into place, and that's assuming the elections are held to be credible and don't simply represent the Shiites and the Kurds with the Sunnis left out. Which is something that's still up in the air, a question that still hasn't been determined. But there are a lot of interesting names in this United Iraqi Alliance list of 228 candidates, and because of the backing of al-Sistani, these are the people who are going to be elected. There's almost no question that this is going to be the electoral majority, the people who will be in the new parliament. Our old friend Ahmed Chalabi is on the list. And at number 10 amongst the candidates, he will almost unquestionably get in. He will have a seat in the new parliament. Several of the different major Shiite parties are heavily represented. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Dawa Party, both of them having ties to Iran because they were in exile there during the during the rule of Saddam Hussein. They are heavily represented, so Iraq got to find out who its new leaders will be this week. One person who was not on that list, interestingly enough, was Ayad Alawi, who is the current prime minister, or president there. No, prime minister, I'm sorry, there. He was not on the list. He is part of a different, more secular party, the Iraqi National Accord. But they will have their list that was registered this week also. Because it's not part of the list that al-Sistani put out, it's questionable whether Alawi will actually be in the new parliament.
Well, that's the problem with selections.
Sometimes, and it's the problem with democracy in Iraq, because it should ring vaguely familiar for those of us who are atheists here in America, that you have a solid majority of people who are devoutly religious, and they constitute a majority in Iraq. And in a democracy where all you need is 50% plus one of whoever votes, that's going to be who holds sway, and you're going to have a minority, in this case the Sunni minority, that's run Iraq for the last 35 years, and it was used to having all the perks that went with having itself represented in the regime of Saddam Hussein. They're going to be shut out of the new government, is what it looks like, and that's a prescription for civil war. That's something that we've talked about on this program a lot.
All right. Well,
so we had also Colin Powell going to Brussels this week, fishing for more support for the training of new Iraqi troops for the new army that's being put together.
Was he using new lures this time?
Well, I don't know what lures he had, but they weren't working very well. Maybe he could do the old soft shoe and say, now that I'm leaving, can't you do one for your old friend Colin? Because you're going to have to deal with these unfathomable people after I leave. Whatever he used didn't work very well. He didn't get his way. A number of countries that were involved in the NATO alliance took the really unprecedented step of saying that they would not allow their troops to be used to be deployed in Iraq, even though NATO as a whole had agreed to help the new Iraqi army. So you had France, you had Germany, you had Belgium, you had Luxembourg, you had Greece, and you had Spain all saying, no, we're not going to send troops there. The International Coalition of the Willing is not looking very willing at this point. And you have, once again, in 2005, a number of the other smaller countries and even some of the larger countries like Poland saying they're going to be taking their troops out of Iraq. It's more and more looking like the United States and Britain are going to be going it alone for the long haul, because it does not look like, elections notwithstanding, that the troop commitment to Iraq is going to alleviate itself anytime soon.
All right. And very briefly, a report came out this week.
Oh yeah, there was also a report that that came out that took an overview at who had benefited from the war in Iraq in terms of contracts. And no surprise here, the big winner was Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary, $10.8 billion in contracts, many of them no bid. Of course, Halliburton being the company that was run by Dick Cheney before he elevated himself to vice president with the help of voters in 2000. Halliburton is actually under investigation on any number of fronts right now, and including the Army saying it might withhold 15% of future billings as a punitive measure for past fraud from Halliburton. But that hasn't prevented it from being the huge winner so far in the Iraq Gold Rush sweepstakes.
All right. Okay, well, we've got several events to mention here real quickly. Can I just pound through those?
Let's talk about John Foss.
Yeah, talk about John Foss.
He is a wonderful volunteer for Eat the State who has found himself in the hospital this month with some sort of a severe colon condition that will require surgery that has him in a bad way. And being one of our intrepid volunteers, he has no health insurance. He has very little means of support of any means. This is a guy who is a force behind the distribution of ETS. You may have seen him at a lot of events out there with his hand truck handing out copies of the paper. He really gets all over the city and hands out thousands of copies of ETS every issue that we put out. So he helps support us. We want to help support him. And there will be a benefit. It'll be tomorrow night, right?
Tomorrow night at Mr. Spot's Chai House in Ballard. Starting at 6 o'clock, and Mr. Spot's Chai House is at 5463 Leary Way.
And what sort of program or music will there be?
It's the first half from 6 to 8 is a feast, and then 8 o'clock is music by local artists. And it's $20 asked at the door for if you're going for the food and music, or just $10 donation if you're going for the music at 8 o'clock.
Great. Well, we want to support him. A lot of people came forward for me last summer when I had medical problems and a bill, and it's important to do that for all the people who help work for a better world like John.
Definitely. And with that, we're pretty much out of time, talking once again to Jav Parrish, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And in addition to where people can find Eat the State, you guys are also doing a fundraiser.
A pledge drive. We do a fundraising drive twice a year. We're in the midst of it right now, at the end of the year. If you're thinking of Christmas gifts, ETS subscription makes a great Christmas gift, or donations for year-of-end tax purposes. That's all great. Eat the State's been coming out for 9 years now. It's very much a shoestring operation. And we depend very much on three things: advertising from cool local businesses who help us out, and then subscriptions, and then donations, particularly from most all of them are small donations from subscribers and people who appreciate what we do. And we're in the midst of that right now. It costs about $800 or $900 to put out an issue every time we do that, every couple of weeks. So the bills add up. We need the money. We're behind with the printer bill, as we almost always are. But it's Lance Scott who does all of the accounting and administration for us, and does wonderful stuff, is particularly urgent in saying we need support, and please mention on the radio how desperate we are. So we'll mention that. You can help support us over the internet. We have PayPal now on our website at www.eatthestate.org. That's where all our back issues are and our current issues as well. And you can donate through the mail. The address is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. We're happy to accept checks in any denomination. Large denominations are wonderful, but small ones are too. We're very much a volunteer organization, so every little bit helps. If you want to help out volunteering, we can always use that too, whether it's distributors like John Foss or writers or people to help with selling advertising, any of that kind of stuff. So you have the website, www.eatthestate.org. You can also give us a call if you'd like to volunteer, if you'd like to find out about donations, or if you'd like, if you have heard things that you want to respond to on this program, any of that stuff. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.